Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Alan Salkin, one of the occasional hosts of New Books in Food, one of the channels of the spectacular and amazing New Books Network, which has channels on every possible topic you can imagine, from new books in Near Eastern studies to new books in psychoanalysis to this channel, which is New Books in Food, which I started way back a few years ago. Now has a lot of hosts, a lot of great content. I'm the author of From Scratch, Inside the Food Network. I also have two other books. One is about Festivus, and my newest book is called The Method to the Madness, an oral history of Donald Trump, 1999 to 2015. But don't worry, not talking about politics today, talking about food, and specifically the 2020 Zagat Guide to New York City Restaurants, a beloved guidebook known to generations of New Yorkers that disappeared for a while when Google owned it and stopped publishing the hard copy, but it has returned and under the ownership of The Infatuation. And we talk about all that and more, the history of it, with Hillary Reinsberg, editor-in-chief of The Infatuation and of the new Zagat Guide. Enjoy.
Hi.
Hi.
I know you made a t-shirt that said, this is, what did it say?
It said, it's pronounced Zagat, but of course we don't actually give the pronunciation explanation, so.
Yeah, which is how Zagat pronounces his name, right?
Correct, yeah. We often tell people it's Zagat like the cat. It's rhymes with cat. But that's been one of the fun things a lot of people have asked us since we acquired the brand about a year and a half ago. People have said, okay, so my first big question is, they either want to know, are you bringing the book back or how do you pronounce it?
And I did the Tarjay treatment to it for many years, Zagat, because I think I'm cleverer than everybody else. That's just Jenna's attitude.
No, I like that. I haven't heard that before. That's a new one.
Zagat. Oh, that's great. I'm so happy.
Yeah. It's very, no, I really haven't. And I feel like I've heard almost everyone, every other permutation of this. So that's good.
Well, speaking of Tim Zagat, when I was at NYU Journalism School back in the room, I deliberately slurred that. Brian Miller, who was then the New York Times restaurant critic, talked about how he and Tim would just sort of do what now is called the bang, 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 where they would just get in a car and go to, you know, eat four or five dinners in a row at restaurants. Did Tim help out? Is he around? Did you interact with him?
Sure. We know Tim. Tim has been a really great friend, as well as Nina, to our company. Tim and Nina Zagat, who are the co-founders, and they're still married, since, you know, founded the company in 1979. They sold it to Google, who then had it for about 7 years before we acquired it. So Tim and Nina don't have an official role, but they are really close friends to the company and have helped us through and been advisors. They celebrated at the 40th anniversary event that we had at Gramercy Tavern. So we've had many meals together, had many conversations, and their insights have been really helpful. And I think we really share the same values towards thinking about restaurants and the founding of the Infatuation and the founding of Zagat actually, I think, share a really similar story in a lot of ways.
How so?
You know, both came from the approach of filling a hole of something that wasn't being served in food media at the time or in restaurant discovery at the time. You know, Tim and Nina said, our friends know, you know, we think our friends know a lot about restaurants, and we should sort of survey people who are restaurant goers to find out about, to sort of find out and have a different approach to discovering restaurants. And the Infatuation was founded with the premise that what's, you know, it was really about situational dining and also reacting to a time in New York when they felt like, hey, it feels like there's something new that would be online, written in a different voice and style. So although the Infatuation has always come from an editorial perspective of a small group of writers who write all the reviews, whereas Zagat has always been written by thousands of people who reply to the survey, I think a lot of the values and ways of thinking about that are really common, and that's why the brands work really well together.
Okay, so now let's do the required step back. And
sure.
What was Zagat? It was a dining guide that came. It was a red little sort of rectangular, standing up on its side book, that contained reviews of what seemed like every restaurant or every restaurant other than, you know, takeout joints, you know, Chinese takeout places, et cetera, that you might go to. And the reviews were these little capsules that were somehow compiled from quotes. So there would be like three or four different little snippets of quotes in the review. And then it was accompanied by numbers, and then the numbers were ratings on a 30 scale. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. It was, you know, started in 1979 when Tim and Nina Zagat started circulating this survey to their friends.
I'll interrupt you for one second. I'm sorry, but it's also important to know that it was extremely important book in New York City. Like, everyone had one. You kept it with you whenever possible because you never knew when you were going to need, you know, you weren't going to be at home and you needed a restaurant. People would end up buying like multiple copies because they'd run into a bookstore because they need to know. There was no internet.
That's exactly why it's in the shape that it is. The idea is that it could fit in your coat pocket or a purse or maybe a large pocket. It does actually fit in the back of a jeans pocket quite easily. And so the idea is that it was actually that you could carry it around in your coat pocket or your bag or whatever. What you said is just right. The survey grew and it was always based on this survey that was distributed to thousands or tens of thousands of New Yorkers. And then eventually people in cities all over the world who became, you know, and this was really the first time that any form of user generated content existed. So it was a chance for diners to actually give their opinions before they could do it on other websites or other places. So that, you know, grew in popularity. And then a group of editors would call together this long list of reviews. And so let's say, you know, this restaurant, Le Bernardin, receives, you know, several hundred comments, and an editor looks through all of them and curates that into a, let's say, you know, 50 to 70 word blurb. And that is exactly what we did with the book when we brought it back this year as well. Diners also vote on food decor and service, and that's what those 30-point ratings represent. And we brought the book back this year after acquiring the brand a year and a half ago. We brought back the New York City book. We have a lot of other plans for the brand as well. But, you know, the one thing people kept asking us was, are you going to bring back the book? And we thought it was a kind of important way to show that the brand was in good hands, that we really understood its history, and people wanted it. So we went about doing it over the past year.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you know this, but I'll just – and I want to ask your biography a little bit too, but I can't help.
Sure.
You know, when Google bought it and paid a good price for it, they basically stripped it thinking they could turn it into, you know, a Yelp-like product or something. And they had digital plans for it. And the book was this like tangential thing that for a while they kept going. I mean, I'm friends with Kelly Dopkin, who worked at Google. I would talk to her all the time about, you know, they basically, as far as I know, they kept the New York guide going just because of customer demand, but then they killed it because it's just not their thing. And then for a long time, I'm saying this because I feel like you're not going to want to piss on Google, but, you know, it was frustrating because it was really a mismatch. And I'm so glad that you guys, you know, resuscitated it. And I'm going to lean on you in a little while to force you to try to make some news. But tell me about you. And you grew up in New York City, but where in New York City?
I grew up uptown, mostly on the Upper East Side, briefly on the Upper West Side as well, now live in downtown Manhattan. I did go to high school in New York City, so I've lived here forever, grew up with the Zagat book in my house, certainly. I was just at my parents' house recently and saw several books from the 90s, 2000s. I think you'll find that in a lot of New York City apartments, or you'll find people have them from many decades past.
You don't want to tell me what high school you went to?
Oh, sure. I went to Horace Mann, which is in Riverdale in the Bronx, for many, many years of the whole way through. And then I went to the University of Pennsylvania, came back to New York after that. And I always wanted to be an editor. I worked for every possible school paper there was that existed from high school on, and did things like that in college as well. So I started a blog that was part of the school magazine and sort of things of that nature, and was just really excited about launching new products in media. And once I basically said, like, you know, I had helped start this website in college and said, basically just wanted to figure out how to do something like that for a job. So landed at a media company called Abrams Media, and then landed at BuzzFeed for a couple of years, where I worked on the news as they were developing their journalistic operation and news operation. It wasn't called BuzzFeed News at the time. It was just BuzzFeed. And we were all in a room, you know, with everything from, we were covering the 2012 election, but also, you know, celebrity cats were also coming into the office at the same time. And there was this very fun mix of all those things happening at once. And then in 2000,
the cats were famous.
Oh yeah. You know, like Grumpy Cat. And I think there was a very famous one that came to the office that passed away recently. And I saw a lot of Twitter tributes to it. So things like that, you know, there were like always internet culture was happening in the same place as political conversation, which we actually, you know, the philosophy of BuzzFeed was that made a lot of sense, that was the way people live their lives, is we do like pet our dogs and look at pictures of animals and funny memes and talk about what's happening on TV, and also we're talking about politics. And I think that's only become more and more true with the evolution of Twitter and Facebook and these things all being on the same page. But, you know, newspapers have also been doing that for decades. And that was the philosophy there, was a blend of all those things. And I did not write about food. I was always interested in it. I, you know, grew up here, loved to travel, was always sort of adventurous in my exploration of food and travel and all of those things, and loved seeking out new places. But so I covered technology and culture and politics. And as I said, the BuzzFeed way, they encouraged, you know, sort of diving into different things. I wrote about YouTube. I wrote about, you know, women in business, that things that don't necessarily all seem connected, but actually were, you know, in one way or another. And while I was editing a fairly like heavy piece, actually, it was all, you know, on the side, you would write fun pieces. So it was in the height of the Corona, actually, if you can remember, in like 2014, the Corona, people were lining up down the street, which, by the way, people are still doing. I walked in steps. So the other day, and I was like,
written about, you know,
on Saturdays in Soho, people still line up for Cronuts, which is quite a testament, I think, to what they've done there. But so I wrote this piece that was about foods, underhyped foods, essentially, in New York City that should deserve more hype. And, you know, kind of polled everyone I knew and put together this list. I just thought it was fun. And I had come up in media in the time that you really had to, you know, be your own publicist in a lot of ways. And do, I mean, I think you still do, but you know, you had to send links to be included in someone else's link roundup, or you would kind of trade, like, I'll tweet this if you tweet that. And that was even pre BuzzFeed, working for a site called Mogulite that was part of the Mediaite family of science, which still exists. And that was just part of like what you did on at the end of the day was, okay, I got to get this. How am I going to get this shared around? We didn't have the spread that you now have, like on Facebook, or on, you know, people weren't thinking about newsletters, I don't think, as in as sophisticated a manner. So you would trade links. And it was just this habit of like, you wrote something about something that seemed relevant to someone else and you would just send it to them. It wasn't something I even thought twice about. And I carried that with me to BuzzFeed. So I wrote this piece about food and I thought, okay, I'm going to send it to some food people that I like. And I had been reading this site called Immaculate Infatuation at the time, written by these two guys in the music business. And my friends and I just loved their food reviews. We related to them. It was helpful to us. You know, we were all working hard and on the weekends wanting to go to a group dinner or something. That was what we turned to. We trusted their recommendations. So I sent it to them saying, hey, you guys might find this interesting. Check it out. And they were like, this is cool. And, you know, Andrew Steinfeld was one of the co-founders, worked in publicity. Chris worked in marketing. And like, they responded and they connected with me and they were thinking about it. And certainly did not send that email with the intention of a job, but we got to know each other. They invited me to a party. And a couple months later, they reached out and said, would you be interested in coming and sort of joining us as our first editorial person? And I said, yes, this is actually just the type of thing I'm excited about. Something that blends editorial with something entrepreneurial. And that was over 5 years ago.
Yeah, I wrote. People think I'm a food writer, and I am sometimes, but my main thing is food media. I wrote a book on the history of the Food Network. So it's really a story about media and television and everything else and a brand. And so, you know, the founder of the Food Network, the guy that actually had the idea was not a guy who cooked. He was obsessed with pizza and then the takeout pizza. And then the first president of Food Network, Reese Schoenfeld, did not have a kitchen in his apartment. He and his wife, they lived at the Des Artistes building on the Upper West Side, mm-hmm. and they'd had the kitchen removed for space, and they just had a coffee maker and like a cabinet for dog food.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I am certainly not like, I would not be... I should not be writing recipes.
Right.
I am capable of cooking, but certainly an amateur cook, and you know, certainly read a lot of it. Love to cook, but I didn't come to it from a place of being an accomplished cook in any way. I definitely came to writing about food and restaurants much more as a journalist and a consumer of restaurants. And we find that to be the case with the writers that we've hired on the Infatuation for a while. They're thinking like, you know, what we want is for them to be thinking in the mindset of the restaurant goer. And that's, you know, I think that's what really any kind of good journalist or critic does, is has some expertise and has knowledge of the space, but is able to translate that to an audience that isn't paying attention necessarily to this stuff day in and day out.
Yeah, the right,
you know, following chefs and trends and all of that. Like, that's not, you're looking for a restaurant, you want an entertaining, informative piece of writing, but you're not necessarily, you know, so we've always come and we've come at least with that approach to the food space, is making sure that people don't feel alienated by what they're reading. And that can happen in a lot of different ways. But that we're kind of informing and thinking from a normal,
all kinds of turnoffs.
Exactly.
Before I turn away from you for a second, was your mom a good cook? Or your dad, or was there good food in your house, or was it mostly not that great and you looked forward to going to restaurants?
No, we had good food in my house. You know, it was
my mom was a terrible cook.
Okay. We had pretty good food. It wasn't like, I think my mom's actually very good at like composing things like salads. No, not takeout. We really didn't eat takeout during the week much, but
she's good at composing.
We did have our Chinese.
Yes.
We had our Chinese delivery spot on Friday nights that we would do. Parents would be out and about. So yeah, you know, it was nothing crazy, but yeah, we cooked and I did, you know, we learned there was cooking happening in my house, and we also enjoyed like going out to dinner with each other as well. And so I certainly grew up doing that too.
That you miss that's gone?
Oh, that's a good question. Oh, I don't know. Well, there was this restaurant called Our Place on the Upper East Side that I don't know if it exactly still exists. It's like changed ownership and management. That was our Chinese delivery spot, which is really good. And my friend famously always would come over and spend Friday nights with my brothers and I, and we'd always order in from Our Place. And she always, years later, she actually was living close to there. And she's like, "What's your Chinese place called?" And I said, "Our Place." And she's like, "No, but what's it called?" And I said, "No, that's actually the name." And she's like, "Oh my God, for 20 years, I thought it was not called that." There was like an Italian restaurant called Parma on the Upper East Side that still exists that we used to go to. There's another one called Girasol. Like, they're not places that I particularly long to return to. They're just like, you know, it's the first place like ate pesto pasta. And, but, you know, always, even going back, you know, pretty far, like my brothers and I were always interested in like exploring different neighborhoods. And there was something, even as soon, you know, definitely, certainly when I got to college in Philadelphia, I was always interested in, checking out different neighborhoods and knowing, and like that was already becoming a thing, was like, let's go drive to this place. It's supposed to have great pizza, or we've heard, you know, the best, like Philadelphia has great Vietnamese food, which is not, you know, there wasn't so much of that in New York at the time. So we heard from, I majored in urban studies, and so we were always exploring the city and like going to, okay, so like we were like heard that there was this really great place to eat pho and things like that. So I was always exploring that stuff, and that was family, friends, you know, that those values were kind of shared in among my community at large, through family and friends.
And speaking of Philadelphia, you know, I had that experience of arriving there once for business or I don't know what. And, just the first thing I did was go to the bookstore and buy the Zagat for Philadelphia, which was about $10 at the time. Now, I see that the book on Amazon is doing really well. It's the, you know, it's the number one like urban guide or whatever, they're, you know, one of those weird divided bestseller lists. But even overall, it's like the number 2000 something on Amazon, which is a very good number. So the thing is selling. I don't know if you have any stats on how well it's done yet.
Yeah, as you said, you know, it's done. It's been selling really well. We've been, you know, we were like at number 11 on Amazon. We've been listed in Publishers Weekly and in trade paperbacks at number 4, I think. And so numbers have been, you know, it's hard to compare it to something else. Obviously the book hasn't been out in a couple of years, but we printed 60,000. They've been selling really well. We feel, I mean, I think it's certainly like going in, not knowing what to expect. We've never published a book before. You know, we had a lot of great people helping us who whether worked for Zagat before or worked in the industry who've helped us understand that this is doing great. The reaction has been like really positive across the board. And we've seen, you know, we've also been doing the corporate sales, which famously Zagat, like for its whole history, was extremely successful in selling as holiday gifts to companies. So like HSBC would buy like a huge number of books. That's the one I actually saw on a bookshelf recently. It was like a HSBC one from 2009 or something. And, you know, company, there's, you know, Tim Zagat has amazing stories about just some of these massive orders that came in, and it was really brilliant. You know, it's an under $25 gift. It was something people wanted. It fit into sort of some of the regulations around that. So amazing gift. And that, you know, we saw some interest in that as well, and did those, saw people print them up for law firms and wealth management firms and dentist office, everything. So yeah, it's an interesting thing. So it's been selling really well in bookstores and on Amazon. And it's also been, we've also been picking up that corporate sales business, which has been just like, look, the great thing about that is it's been a great way to get it into people's hands. You know, this is anecdotal, but people have just been really excited. Every time we give them a book, they're like, "Oh, thank you. Wow." You know, the act of being able to give someone a physical thing has been, having worked in digital media for my whole career, that being able to give people that physical item has, I've been kind of surprised by how that's felt and how excited people have been about that.
Yeah, and of course, I've already lost mine. It's under a pile somewhere here.
Well,
in LA, so I'm not using it day by day.
Okay, well,
I'm excited. I opened it up. I was thrilled. And now
we can send you another one.
But you know, I also, you know, books is a different business. The scale's different. You know, it's print. You know, if you've got 60,000 hits on a story, that'd probably be pretty good, but you wouldn't be doing backflips. Whereas selling, if you could sell that print run, that would be awesome for a book.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, I think we all know that, like, comparing, you can't do apples to apples in different, an Instagram like versus a story read versus buying a book versus going to see a movie. They're all really different. So we're not really looking to compare those numbers to anything else. But, you know, making sure that it's a good business for us, which it has been. And it's also helped us, you know, I think there's more to it there. It's helped the brand get back into the world. It's helped show that it's in good hands. We know what we're doing. And look, we have really big ambitions for what we're going to do with the brand beyond this one book. And this is really just the kickoff. So having that and having that been a success has just been a really great start. And we're kind of like 1 mile in. And so, you know, in 2020, we're launching a handful of other exciting things. So like it was the 40th anniversary of the brand. It was really the first big kickoff thing that we did with it. And it felt really good. And I think we're coming out of it just, you know, we came out like 6 weeks ago or maybe 5 weeks ago. So it's hard to make a complete analysis on like exactly the future of it and all of that, but we feel really good about it so far.
Well, you know, I'm holding what I could find was my Michelin guide 2019 to California.
All right.
In LA has been really, kind of controversial because Jonathan Gold, you know, the late Jonathan Gold, the great restaurant critic, he did not want Michelin here. He felt it was, you know, creating a standard that is not an LA restaurant type. We don't care about, you know, the whiteness of the, you know, napkins or whatever. And, so I'm not asking you to like opine on Michelin, and I'm not saying my Michelin guide is more important than my Zagat guide. But what I do want to know, and you're not going to answer, but I want you to know anyway, is when one for LA, a book. And by the way, I know you're launching Zagat Stories, and you know, I'm going to talk about that too. But we're getting an LA book. I guess if I can tell people that, I would get news. I would make news.
I don't think I can make news for you on that. But
how about
what we are? What I can tell you is we're launching a digital product in the next year. That's going to allow us to be in a lot of cities. So we're going to be launching serving the same purpose as the book, a digital product that will be user generated, but curated, that will be an answer to, you know, will be an answer to Zagat. And like Michelin operates a different way. So, you know, they use critics who died anonymously, and it's a different model.
Sure.
So books, I don't have any, I can't really say what the future of doing the books is going to be. However, launching this again. No, we're still figuring that out. Okay. What I do know is that we're definitely going to be launching a Zagat digital product that will be in many cities.
Yeah,
and eventually worldwide. So that's an evolution of that's going to be happening in the next year. And whether that also includes a book component will remain to be seen. We got to figure out sort of what makes the most sense, what there's demand for, what the market supports, how we get this brand into more cities.
I see on Zagat.com, when I pull it up here in LA, it just immediately goes to best steakhouses in LA, where to eat in Grand Central.
Yeah. So that the... Nice. Our site is the website that you see there is in transition. It's not what you're going to be seeing for all time. So we'll be, you know, throughout 2020 launching a new product that people will be able, as they contributed to the survey, like you'll be able to contribute to Zagat. And we've long felt with the infatuation that there is like this important space to have a really great platform for people who really love restaurants to be involved in a community where you're submitting reviews of restaurants and rating things in that sense. So certainly there will be a Zagat presence in LA soon.
In a lot of places, but
whether it is in a lot of places, whether it is made out of trees or not, you know, is still remains to be seen.
I hope so, but you know, I hear you.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On Amazon, I was looking some of the reviews, positive and negative, and just to, you know, and this leads to a question of how you, the mechanics of how it was put together this time, since, you know, I used to actually fill out the surveys way back when.
Yeah.
The deal was supposed to be that when you filled out the survey, they would send, you know, they would send mm-hmm. you a book for free.
Yes.
And I would always complain that I never got my damn book. And then, you know,
okay.
I complained so vociferously that they finally sent it to me. But I probably could have sold 10 freelance stories with the amount of letters that I wrote complaining. But on Amazon, one of the reviews complains that, like, there's not enough theater district restaurants. Does it have as many restaurants as the old one did? Is it just that there's more restaurants in New York now? Or
there are 1,400 restaurants in the book. So there is a lot of coverage. I don't exactly know what the number was on the last one, but I think, you know, it's broader than ever. There are a lot of theater district restaurants, I would say. And you know, the mechanics of putting it together, I think, were probably pretty similar to they were in the past. And the survey was run in quite a similar way as it was in the past as well.
Restaurants didn't pay because one of the reviews said
certainly not.
They had, you know, oh, these restaurants must not have paid. You were charging to be included. That's not true, right?
Absolutely not. Both on the infatuation and Zagat, we don't do any business with restaurants. That's not our business model, and we certainly don't accept that. And you know, have measures in place to make sure that people aren't cheating per se and things like that. So certainly no pay for play.
You remember ramen burgers?
I do. They were listed on I thought you were just asking me this. I did tweet that recently. We were talking about trends of the decade and ramen burgers and kind of like the Franken foods of the decade, like sushi burritos or something that we were discussing as something that that I think you'll look back and be like, oh, that was such a 2010s thing, you know? Mm. Like the sun-dried tomatoes of of the 90s or whatever.
Those are good, you know?
Yes, sun-dried tomatoes are totally good. It was just that they were on every dish. And we featured those on the infatuation. We do a very comedic top 10 Fridays on Instagram stories. And we listed mutant foods, I think, as like number two. Our number two worst trend of the decade, along with like rainbow bagels. I think those are things that you'll look back and be like, oh, yes, that was such a 2015 thing.
In fact, and I don't know if this was I think you were somebody on Infatuation came up with a list of lists that you're not actually
one with. Yeah.
A list of restaurants where you can while having $75 hand lotion or something.
Oh yeah. Well, we were joking about our infatuation writers. Like, the infatuation's always taken a really humorous, irreverent tone. You know, respectful of restaurants, respectful of all the work that the chefs do. But like, we also have fun, and that's not at the expense of restaurants. It's at just like bringing a humorous approach to the writing. And so at the end of the year, we always just have fun, and a couple of the cities put together like 10 rejected guide ideas, because we do guides to everything. Like, you know, we'll do some silly guides like we did where to eat. We have a guide that's been really popular, where to eat near the restaurants that are near the subway when it's too cold to walk more than a block. And that's a real thing that people really love. And so we do joke ones. I'm like, they're totally jokes. So I think one of them was like where to eat in Brooklyn Heights and see Adam Driver, things like that. Or like restaurants. One of my favorites was restaurants you didn't think were restaurants and aren't. And then it was like, I think we had, but best. I'll pull it up. It's best restaurant windows to stare out of while you listen to Evanescence.
Yes.
Bars where you have to, where you probably have to pick up your credit card keys and phone the next day. Things like that. So we had fun with it. Yes, there was one of those great NYC restaurants where you can have a generous helping of $75 lotion.
That's it.
That was reacting to just like, however, you know, what restaurants have nice, restaurants having nice soap and Aesop soap and things in the bathroom.
About LA is that it's not crawling with people like you in a way. Like, I mean, you know, I moved here 2 years ago, and I love it, but that, and I like this and hate this as a writer. Like in New York, there's probably 10 other writers have walked by, you know, something and already thought of 4-story ideas, you know, on their way to work. Whereas here, it's still very virgin territory. But then you're also like frustrated because like I live in Silver Lake and every single store in Silver Lake, no matter what else they sell candles.
And crystals?
There's
some crystals for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. And candles are very popular.
Coachella hats usually.
Yeah. I've been to that store in Silver Lake. Yeah. I know there are many, but like there's one right next to like LaMille Coffee. That's the store I'm thinking of. That is the candle store. The candle and maybe some crystals on like Oddities store.
Well, when you're LaMille, you can just call it the center of the known universe.
Okay, sure.
Anyway.
But look, I think our infatuation LA writers are quite funny, and our lead LA writer was in The Groundlings and like
right.
Very much come from a comedic place, and just read his review of Vespertine, which I think caused quite a stir. And I think he'll understand like our approach to things, not exclusively. Well, but
let's talk about that because I was going to ask you the. And yeah, there's a lot of other great talents in LA, and it's exciting here. And
yeah, it's great stuff. I mean, media in LA is probably like, I think the most exciting it's ever been.
Oh yeah, no, and the LA Times is, and what Peter Meehan's done with the food section is spectacular. And the whole paper, I mean, it's wonderful and thrilling.
Yeah, there's for a while there were really kind of, you know, we were
yes
felt like there wasn't a ton of food writing critics, and it's great to see a lot of it out there now.
And if you've never listened to Jordan Oken, he has a great podcast about LA restaurateurs. But
cool,
Air Jordan. But I was talking about the Vespertine review, which I have not
yeah.
read, and I will. But one nice thing about Zagat is, in a way, because it's user generated content, the chefs can't really, you know, complain as much. But have they?
No, I think and they really haven't had a bunch of negative feedback, but it really does, as you said, it comes from the surveys and the people, and of course those are edited and curated, but the scores and all the things that are said are come from the community of people, and they also come from a lot of people, so it's not just if something, whether positive or negative or neither, is said. It's, you know, we're not including it if one person says like the service is terrible. The things that get included are a theme or something like that. So in general, if people like, or one place says like, wow, the X is fantastic here. It's typically because like that's shown up several times and our editors were keeping those things in mind. So it's like, yes, this is something that several people said and, you know, the restaurants need to, like it needs to actually show to be a real trend and a real opinion that's backed by several people who took the survey.
And how did word go out about the survey? And the survey was done online
sure.
this time. We didn't.
Yes.
Nobody had to.
It's been done online for a while. Certainly through the Google days, even I believe in the Gap days. By the early 2000s, it was done online. I think in 2003, maybe I'd have to check. So we have, you know, we of course like own all of Zagat. So the newsletters, social media, like all the platforms that they were already reaching, we reached out to those people. We sent it out to the infatuation audience. We also, you know, press, it was written about, it was covered in the New York Times. So people found out about it that way. And we also did outreach to things like neighborhood blogs and community groups to make sure that we also were representing the whole city. So making sure that all the boroughs were covered, as many neighborhoods as possible were covered, and we wanted to make sure that we were getting, you know, a broad array of responses from all different types of people.
And we got ratings and reviews.
Yeah. So we looked at the feedback. We knew we needed to get a certain threshold of responses in order for it to be like essentially statistically significant, based on, you know, the survey experts that we were working with. And we hit that so quickly that we were, that's when we kind of knew, okay, this was good. This was going to be good.
Speaking of future plans, do we know just about New York? Will there be a 2021 one?
I cannot say that yet. Okay. Still figuring that out. And I, you know, the book's still on sale and going to see where things continue to go. But in 2020, we'll definitely, you know, we'll be launching, as you mentioned, Dagat Stories, which is going to be really like a companion site, an editorial site, talking about the industry. So you'll see that soon. And then you'll also see the site, this new platform launching. And so there will be more, and there will certainly be more opportunities for people in New York and other cities to contribute their opinions to the survey and have those be fed back into the world in some form.
Now I have a question written in front of me that says, how did Eats help? So you guys run a food
festival. We do. A food festival called EatsCon. We don't pronounce it with all the E's, but you certainly can. The short history of the short history.
Said, okay, Gen X to me, but go ahead.
No, not at all. Short history of the festival and short history of the Eats hashtag. Look, when the infatuation was really built on the back of social media in such a big way in terms of us reaching audience, like just talking to people on Twitter, building a community on Instagram, that was such a big part of the way that the brand grew. And it was really through that and word of mouth that it got out into the world. And oftentimes people say, that's how they first found out about us. So just shortly before I started, the infatuation was on Instagram, and there were all these hashtags that people were using, like hashtag foodie, hashtag nom nom. And it was all these things that we were like, we're never, you know, our founders were like, we would never really use those hashtags. They feel kind of dorky and not something we would want to use. And so a friend was like, well, what if it was just something, like, they were like, we should just come up with something silly to define our community. And so someone was like, how about Eats with five E's? And it became this rallying cry for people who felt similarly, you know, who were not too serious, really were passionate about food, but also didn't take it overly seriously. So that hashtag's been around for a while. And like, it kind of grew past us. It's been used over 18 million times now, which is crazy. And it really grew. It's grown into being like, now there's this general food hashtag, but we still feel some ownership over it, certainly in a big way. And so we started a festival called EatsCon, that is really the Infatuation's food festival. Started it in LA, we've done 3 in LA, 2 in New York. And we think of it as really in the spirit, a food festival within the spirit of a music festival. So it's not like tiny little tasting plates or little, you know, no one's walking around with like a glass that's a necklace. You know what I mean?
Hold on, just one sec.
Yeah.
Those things I realize, and that, you know, that kind of got popularized at South Beach, the giant South Beach food festival, and they are obnoxious, and people end up sometimes catching people's vomit because they drink so much. All that's true, and yet when you are walking around a food festival, it is nice having the wine around.
Look, I'm certainly not opposed to the concept of having a wine glass, you know, attached to my body at all times. I see your point, but we do serve a lot of wine and have a whole area called the wine room. And certainly something we're thinking about is talking to people more about wine in our voice as well. So we bring restaurants we love. We bring great music. Lizzo actually performed at the first EatsCon, which really right before she blew up, which was pretty awesome. And we bring just like, you know, we have panels. We had Dwayne Wade speak at the one in New York. We had Dan Levy and Awkwafina in LA. And like, it's a good time. We do it for 2 days. And it's like, you come with friends. Tickets were $30 last year with discounted prices if you bought them early. And you pay for the food on site. You come with a group of friends. You share stuff. And it's like a whole day experience. And it's been just growing over the years, and we'll continue to do so.
And so what, you know, in a way, like what the Zagat Guide is part of it, you know, and books are this way now, you know, as a writer, more and more, you know, I get asked just, you know, they're not even vanity publications. It's like a brand sees the value in a magazine, and it may not be because they're going to sell watch ads, but they just think it connotes a certain luxury or something. So what you're talking about a food festival, and, you know, it's multi-level thing. And, you know, you wear both a editorial and a business hat, which is
certainly,
what a lot of people do now. And I guess I'll make a note to ask you that in a second, but the, you know, I went over actually to, it's probably been 2 years. I went over to Tasty at BuzzFeed in LA.
Yeah.
Beautiful offices. But, and then they made a whole bunch of cutbacks, and it's like, everyone's always trying to figure out, you know, the right model and everything else. And you, oftentimes what is tried is either streaming or even, you know, selling a television show, like in, you know, mm-hmm. graduation TV show. I don't know if, and maybe this has already been tried and I missed it, but I'm curious about whether you're thinking about that, and also like just talking about the question of format. That is the problem with food TV, is nobody, basically everything is either chopped, you know, or Julia Child.
Yeah, I hear you. Certainly we're thinking about all different kinds of formats right now. And,
you know, there's a,
Sure. Lots of good stuff. You know, I think in all those formats, there's stuff that's great and stuff that's not. And we are certainly thinking about different formats, the brand growing and expanding. You'll definitely see stuff in the coming years along the lines of different formats look like. We experimented, our foray into video early on was doing Instagram stories.
Right.
And we found that to be like this great way to take our audience behind the scenes. And I think there are things that we've done on there that could certainly evolve into larger things on multiple different platforms. And we're certainly thinking about where our audience is and where they're going, and the brand being, you know, the brand broadening and not changing, but existing in those different places, like definitely conversations that we're having right now.
So maybe a television show on a mainstream network, branded Infatuation at some point.
Yeah, you know,
it's a fantasy.
Certainly don't know yet, but we're thinking in different places about about what that could look like, and that's look like.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and that's like look like we did a festival. We've done, we're experimenting with some video stuff that will live on different platforms right now with Zagat, and so. We're trying things, and I think the thing is, like, we have a great brand that connects with people, matters to people, and that takes a long time to build on both sides. Zagat has been around for 40 years, and the Infatuation for, you know, for 10, and we're excited to see what that looks like in different formats, in different places.
Yeah, and I think there's a tone that, in a way, it's been Zagat has been respected and not overly infatuated. It's not, it does have like a, you know, and the way, you know, it was put out, it looks the same. It could live.
We went back to the old logo, actually.
Yeah. Oh, right. Oh, there was a. Right. So, it could live next to your parents' old copies and, you know, on the Upper East Side. So,
sure.
Now, and it's funny because you're even, do you have besides being a editor and working on these business propositions, is there a secret memoir or novel that you always wanted to write or that you mean to get back to or someday?
Maybe. I don't know. I have my ideas and things. I'm we're certainly busy right now, and I feel really creatively satisfied by and inspired by the stuff. I feel like I'm especially now as we expand the brand, I feel really fortunate that I'm, you know, getting to lead and help shape something, but also learning a lot right now. You know, I certainly didn't know how to publish a book 9 months ago. I certainly didn't really know much about like TV production, but I have, you know, I do know quite a lot about like how to write about restaurants and how to talk to audience and how to launch websites and things like that. But I've never produce like a massive piece of fiction, but you know, I have my ideas and things, and I would love to write something at some point. But it's not like my, not my primary focus, but you know, I think
sitting in the desk in your journal somewhere.
Maybe a couple things, but no, you know, I think from some past experiences, there are things that I've always wanted to write.
No, not dating.
That's never been like my draw, but I always wanted to write something about a New York City apartment building.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've lived in a couple that have just like had their own quirks and lived in them my whole life, so. I think more, you know, like that type of thing. I worked in like this funny space around like, I also like lived in this funny world in 2012, like right when Lean In came out, and, there was like this corporate feminism thing happening that I always like thought there was something interesting in as well that could have an interesting, there have been some things done. Meg Walter wrote a book that was really great about that topic. And so like, I thought about that. Look, I think there's fun ideas in food and, you know, even on Infatuation, like we've played around with some ideas of scripted things. And so that's been a fun place to learn and play in that space. So maybe someday, but like, I also really love working with people and being in a team and helping shape like a vision and the business side too. So like, I don't know that I would be particularly great at like holding myself up in a and sitting at my desk and just writing, being able to produce that all day. But maybe at a different time of life like that, I don't know. I don't think I'm good at like juggling a lot of different things and my brain being in a lot of places. And I get a little bit of a thrill out of that. So it would take sort of like a different kind of discipline to do that, but I would love to try it sometime and see if I can make it work. Right now, maybe not the time.
It's really hard to do. You say no to a lot of things. And my mind is similar to yours in that way. And I've had to, it's brutal to sit at the desk and to say no and to, and it's also fattening for me because chocolate is the engine.
Yeah, sure. I used to always really like to eat goldfish when I wrote.
Goldfish, yes.
Yeah, like goldfish because they have that.
Oh yeah, no,
they have that cheesy
like Oreos. Yeah,
they have that cheesy processed taste, but they don't get like they don't make your fingers dirty, so you can type while eating them. No, I'm serious. Like that was the reason that goldfish like. They don't have the thing of like, you know, pirate's booty or one of those like Cheeto-esque things where like they make that are you cannot eat that out of the computer.
That is true.
Goldfish, peanut M&Ms, those are what you want to eat while you're typing because they're not going to make your computer disgusting.
So what food do you have in your office now?
we have goldfish sometimes around, but I don't know. There's a mix of all the snacks. People are always getting different things. You know what's like weirdly popular in our office is Baby Bell cheese, which is like such a throwback item, but always very popular. Who knew?
Is it still in the wax? Yeah, or is it?
Yeah, it's still in the wax. It's a weird one. Like someone sort of put that on like the order snack order, and like they always go. People are always very excited about them.
Well, also, they're one of those things that's a little like money, I think. You just feel like, I mean, and also...
Say more.
Well, it's like, it looks like something that's valuable.
Okay, sure.
And you're right, it's also rare. It's like you don't...
It's like
the Bloomberg snack bar when I've been over there. Like, you don't see them.
It's rare, yeah. They're definitely still in the supermarket, but there are a lot of varieties now, but they do seem kind of rare. Like, if you see one, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to have one.
Do they travel?
I have not traveled with one, but I have to imagine that the wax coating, like, I mean, I don't usually leave them in a hot car in LA,
Well, in LA,
so it's freezing on airplanes and stuff anyway that I think it would probably be fine.
In my car, like car
peanuts
like,
are good.
Really useful. I have a food writer.
I feel that.
Food writer fiance who mocks me for my food, my car peanuts.
No, I get it. Peanuts are great. Classic. An American classic.
And you don't have your hot and cold running or cold brew on tap there?
We do have some cold brew on tap. We make coffee. We have tea, you know, just the typical things.
It's funny because you're talking about internet culture and because I was at the New York Times, I was on staff in like 06 to 09, right when we moved to the new building. And, you know, it's like they were building a building to fight the last war, because in the old building, there were no meeting rooms. So they built this building that had like infinite little cubby holes to meet in. But the kitchenettes were still just like circa 1987. You know, it was, you had to pay for everything still, unless you wanted like decaf tea. and it's just, it's interesting how, and you know, and I was fighting the war similar to what you're talking about now, that's expected, where people are promoting themselves on the social media, but there it was almost discouraged at that
time,
even though everyone else, anyway, it's just, I'm still fighting my old war in my mind, but
yeah,
I think that the culture of, you know, internet companies having food around, I'm not the first person to talk about this, but there is something, I don't know, there's something generous and human about it that is also true, I think, amongst food writers, who are surprisingly uncompetitive bunch, I think. We're all kind of, you know, because, I don't know if you've noticed this, but you get invited to a press event, and it's like we're all having this very sort of family-like experience together, where we're eating and drinking in a business context, and it's a funny crossover.
Yeah, I mean, at the infatuation, we really don't, because we're the team is really all critics, and of course, as we evolve, there are people who are writing things and maybe aren't, but in general, our whole editorial team is people who are critics and editors. So we stay away from the press dinners. With a really honest understanding, any sort of PR person in LA or New York would tell you, like, yes, we know the infatuation doesn't come. We want to just make sure that things stay honest and keep those ethics, which it makes sense for people who are reporting and interviewing to be at those things. If you're a critic, it doesn't. I mean, I think you see what the New York Times critics and LA Times critics aren't there either.
Yes.
But I think I still take your point to say that, look, I think the idea of being generous makes sense, because like you're sharing places with people. And people always say to me, one thing that's funny is people always say, oh, don't write about my favorite spot. It's like, I don't want you to know about it. And I'm like, why don't you want that restaurant to, if you really love a place, first of all, don't you want your friends or audience or whatever to know about it and experience that too? Like, you would never say about a piece of music, like, oh, no, don't listen to this music. It's mine, or music, or like a designer or whatever it was, or an artist. So I'm always really excited to share stuff with people. And especially, look, if it's a smaller place that, you know, it's not an easy business. So if there's an opportunity to like support that place because it's great and make sure that they stay in business, like, I think great. So I think there is some, like, look, you gotta call it when places aren't good as well. But
yes,
I think there's, you know, so it's really about being fair. We're never like trying to promote or take away business or anything, but we certainly want to celebrate those places that are kind of undiscovered gems. So,
and things,
so yeah, I'm always like, hey, you guys should go. Like, I would of course tell you, you have to try this place too. I don't think there being multiple reviews of a restaurant is something that anyone feels like, oh, they beat us. Like, you're on breaking news if you went to a restaurant. You know, you're providing a service as a critic. And so, look, I think people read each other's stuff and find out about places through that. And so I think that makes sense. We all want the great restaurants to succeed.
Yes, that was, though, the kind of origins of internet. You know, I wrote the first trend piece about the existence of food bloggers, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just Ben and Lockhart, you know, were the only two people working at Eater then. And that is in a way what the first thing that the food internet did. And, you know, I know we have to wrap up in a minute, but it was actually like, because it was this tradition, the New York Times would wait, you know, months before going to a restaurant. But food internet guys, you know, Eaters started the plywood alert, or the so they would go the first minute a restaurant was open and start writing a review of it. And it definitely changed the way restaurants had openings. And I don't know.
Well, yeah, I hear you. We do sort of something where we do a bit of both. So we put places, we run on the infatuation openings, you know, and it'll be interesting to think about how we do that with Zagat when it is a more user-driven platform, what that will look like. But on the infatuation, we do a couple of things. So we first cover places in openings. So we do an openings list where there's no opinion given. It's just, this is a restaurant open. It is in this area that serves this, and it, you know, et cetera. It's like two sentences. Because there is a world of people who want to track, people want to know, like, a new place opened in my neighborhood, or love to try every new sushi places that open. Like, that's a thing that people want. And then, you know, oftentimes, like, in the early weeks, we'll go check out places, and then we'll put them on what we call the hit list. And that's our list of the best new restaurants. And unlike some other publications that do this, of course, like, everyone does their new restaurants list, we don't add those places until someone has been and can actually confirm, yes, I would suggest sending people there. Because we had this experience where these places get written up, but they're not that great yet, or they're not great at all. And so we are pretty judicious about those decisions, and like, should this place be on? Do we want to send people there? And that's like that first step of coverage of saying this place is good, or if it's not, we might say like, hey, it's not on the list right now, we might revisit it. And then after a certain, you know, a set period of time that feels appropriate, we will write like a full review if it feels warranted. So we've considered all those things and try to do it in a step that feels like a balance of giving people what they want and being responsible. So it kind of goes through like various phases. And we also do ride-alongs where, you know, we do Instagram stories. So oftentimes with new restaurants, especially like big name new openings, we'll kind of cover them in a few different phases. And then sometimes they're on the hit list and then they kind of like drop off and aren't good anymore, or they get way better. And so we give them a bit of time, but we also do that like initial good enough to go, we think you should drive over there, whatever.
That's interesting, multi-level.
And that's evolved over time. Like day one, we didn't do that, but we started saying, oh, let's do this hit list and let's actually go to places. And we're like, oh, let's actually cover openings. Maybe we should put extra stuff in the newsletter. Like that's been a multi-step process that's evolved over 5 years.
I have to ask the last question, which is, are you having any thoughts about this new California freelance law, AB5?
It's interesting. So we don't, our writers in LA and San Francisco are all full-time. So it's not something that we have been making like immediate decisions about right now, but I've certainly been reading about it and making sure, you know, making considerations, but our staff in California are full-time.
Oh, great. Okay.
Our staff writers are. So we have an editor, and staff writers in all of those cities, in those two cities.
Well, I hope there's more Zaja guides.
Zaja, yeah. All right, we're going to use that.
Zaja.
Right. It was great talking to you.
Please credit me at Alan Salkin, and you are Hillary Reinsberg. And
yes.
If you go to your page on the infatuation, all of your
and
Hillary H. Reins on Twitter.
And Instagram, and
yes.
I don't know what other platforms there are, but I'm probably that on there too.
I've never met you in person.
TikTok?
Eating together with you at some point, maybe.
Definitely. Yeah, you got to come to Eats Con in LA in May.
Oh, you're coming in May?
Well, yeah, and I was saying, and you should come.
Oh, that's the Eats Festival?
Eats Con in LA, yeah. In the end of May. It's around May 20th. Okay. Usually end of May is typically the date. I have to look up the exact one, but announcements coming soon about who will be there and tickets on sale in the new year.
Awesome. I will be there. Okay.
Awesome. All right.
See you soon, and thank you so much.
Yes. All right. Bye.